recorded in our very comfy sofa up in various bars around Edinburgh. It's your Saturday edition of the Edinburgh Fringe Podcast. Yes, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are listening. It's a podcast-only show for today, for reasons that will become apparent once you listen to the content of some of our guests. It's not always in the radio studio. There's a number of comedians and theatre shows that have a time clash, or it's really awkward to get to, or they're simply not awake in time. So, we are going to have Gordon Southern, Lucy Paul, Tom Rhodes, and a little bit of music and chat from the cast and crew behind Manuelita as your weekend at the Fringe continues. I like that. We're going to start that with that hearty laugh. I'm going to take that out and use it as my SMS tone on my phone. Yes, the Fringe carries on. And sometimes there are new comedians like, what's this interview radio podcast thing? And there are some that are just like, okay, right, I'll just do what my PR tells me. And then there's Gordon who goes, oh, Ewan, are we just doing it all again? Are we in the same place?
There's a sense of deja vu. This is the third year on the bounce that we've been sat on this sofa.
But there is a difference this year.
Well, there's a slight difference. You've always had a bit of a badger streak in your facial hair, but I've got a little bit of white in my beard. So, dear listeners, we look like a pair of, I don't know, middle-aged male badgers just chewing the fat down in Somerset today.
See, I was going with the Pleasance realised, because we're recording this in Brooks Bar at the Pleasance, that I'd been recording in other bars last year, and now they're putting on free croissants for the first time in 9 years.
We are both enjoying a free croissant. That's the sound of me tearing through a free croissant.
And little pots of jam. And all I can think of is these pots of jam are going to be stolen by all the comedians who don't have any money for food.
This may well be the case.
You've got a couple spare in your pocket, haven't you?
I have not. I'm incredibly wealthy. How dare you?
Gordon.
Yes.
Tell us about the show this year, because I'm looking at the flyer and it really, you know, the title is your new favourite comedian, but let's be honest, what it should actually say is I was David Tennant's stunt double.
There's a whiff of David Tennant about the picture. Yeah, a startled David Tennant in the distance.
Sorry, you've just doubled your female audience.
Hooray! The show is called Your New Favourite Comedian, not from towering arrogance, but because a brilliant Swedish band called The Hives once had an album called Your New Favourite Band, and I thought, that's cheeky, that's kind of arrogant, and that's got a lot of fun, I like it. And then my show is partially a tribute to them, partially a story about me growing up, becoming a comedian, and then going to Australia to sort of find my fortune.
I'm going to stay with the flyer, because I've not seen the show yet, so I only have the flyer to go on, but through the magic of podcasting, I'll make it sound like I've seen the show.
Right.
Because that old style 1950s mic does play quite heavily into it, doesn't it?
It does a little bit. If you've not seen The Hives, they've just got a brilliant sense of showmanship, and I've tried to bring a little bit of that to my stand-up comedy. I've got nothing against a chap with jeans and a T-shirt stumbling onto the stage and mumbling about his life, but the show...
How is Noel Fielding?
He's great. But the show, I don't know, it's more of a show. I dress up a bit and I make it a bit of an event. It's still just me doing stand-up, but there's a few stylistic framing devices around it.
So I know that you've been on this circuit and done the Fringe long enough that I can ask you this. This is just a cheeky concept to get a flyer, to get another hour of stand-up that you've spent 8 months slowly and utterly bashing away, going, what can I call it this year?
Well, no, The Hives were always going to be there, but the brilliant thing is
How many Fringes have you done now?
This will be my 10th solo show.
Right, so basically The Hives are 10th on your list of things that could be a Fringe show.
I guess, yes.
It's not very high, is it?
Into a corner, yeah, I believe
there are nine more important things. The invention of sliced bread, wheels on suitcases. Yeah, all of those are above The Hives.
Wheels on Suitcases was, of course, my 2012 show, and I think sliced bread Julian Barrett covered back in 1845. So, I write a show. Obviously, the title is Your New Favourite Comedian, because there was a deadline for Adelaide back in August of last year.
You've taken this on tour.
Problem. Yeah. The show's already been to Adelaide, been to Melbourne, sold out every show, extra shows. I'm now reinvesting all that money into Edinburgh City Council. But
thank you very much. Have you seen the tram?
You're all incredibly welcome, and enjoy your trip to the airport at speeds of up to 12 miles an hour. The Hives happens to be on tour in Australia while I was premiering this show. So it's like the universe provided me with an extra layer of reality on top of the one that I'd created. So The Hives turn up, I get to see them do a show. as a sort of tribute to me having written a show, that's not how they saw it. And then, even better, Mel, who does my PR, she goes, your show's about the Hives. I used to do PR for a band that toured with the Hives. Would you like one of their white silk ties?
Oh.
So I'm now sporting, as part of the whole Hives aesthetic, an original tie. I don't know who it belongs to. Mm-hmm. Could be Howling Pelle Ormquist. Could be Chris Dangerous. We don't know.
Do you know my best trophy from dodgy indie rock bands of that era?
I'm going to say one of Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine's calipers.
No, because that would leave the other leg looking like that sketch from Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Okay, is it one of Menswear's cloth caps?
It's not, no, it's the former, then the bassist, then the former bassist, and then the bassist of the Darkness's lighter.
I used to love the Darkness. What a great band they were for.
Oh, what a great album.
One and a half albums. One and a half albums. Oh, God, where are they now? They burnt fast and bright, didn't they?
They did have another album out at the start of last year.
But they sort of reinvented themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you had Stone Gods, which is like the half of the Darkness that understood rock music.
Here's the thing, because you are really into your music. I've just discovered that you are a Eurovision aficionado. Is this...
That would probably be a fair initial assumption, yes.
That's incredible, because I've got a theory now.
Oh, we can test this.
I think why the Eurovision is still going on, because during the Prohibition era in America...
Yeah.
Alcohol was illegal, and so stock car racing evolved, because these are
out
cars
of the moonshine runners
that travel around with beefed up suspension so they can carry lots of liquid. Doesn't say what it is. Maybe it's fuel, maybe it's illicit liquor.
Of course, which led to the early 1970s movie The Moonshiners.
Okay, so you're with me. So,
because you know what that turned into.
Out of Prohibition...
Yep.
Don't let me lose my thread, because
I've
got a theory. Right. Out of Prohibition, you get stock car racing. I think out of industrial and political espionage across Europe from the 1960s until the present day, Eurovision exists as a way for international countries to exchange vital information... in hiding in plain sight. So while they're all backstage going, high five, Lithuania, excellent song, Israel, USB sticks are being rummaged out of sequined vaginas and handed into banjos.
Okay, right then. So there are four issues I have with that.
Just four?
To start with, you know, you've put me on the spot.
Yeah.
You know, I've not examined it in great detail, but I love the sort of principle of 1960s, 70s Europe being run by this. But let's start with the issues.
Back then.
Yes. Okay, three issues. Number one. Eurovision started in 1956, so by the time the 60s came around...
Hang on, there's 1956, already Suez crisis... Correct me if I'm wrong.
It was before Suez.
Damn it.
Not by much.
Okay.
Not by much, but and also Britain didn't enter in 56, because we didn't get the forms in time.
Is that right?
We wanted to enter, but they went, no, the deadline was a week ago, you've missed it, try again next year.
Oh, that's like my Buxton Fringe of 2009, I feel your pain. Okay.
Yeah. So couldn't
point one.
So, yeah, already there wasn't any international crisis before Eurovision started. Two, you've stolen the USB microfilm bag. That's a shame. Thirdly, the first piece of banjo at the Eurovision Song Contest, the closest... I mean, if we're very... All right, Balalaika's dead easy. That's the Dubrovnik Troubadours in 1968, singing for Yugoslavia. So you didn't have any banjos until, or ish things, till 1968.
What? That was the first banjo?
The first banjo-esque.
I thought the banjo would be a staple of at least the orchestra pit.
Well, not with the banjo, no.
Here's my next question, because...
Oh, because you don't want to hear the other 2 points. Fair enough.
No, please.
Nobody's ever had a jewelled vagina on stage at the Eurovision Song Contest.
A what? Jewelled vagina?
Yes.
Well, you'll be wearing a spangly leotard and the vagina is underneath it.
Oh, that's where they are.
Yeah. I know it's not a strip show.
And there's also the fact that if the powers were exchanging secrets...
Yeah.
1974 wouldn't have happened.
1974 being the Cod War between Iceland and England?
1974 was the Portuguese Carnation Revolution.
Right.
By the people rising up against the government. And they, let's be fair here, they did use Eurovision.
To political ends.
The Get Ready to Start the Revolution signal was the first chord in Portugal's Eurovision song that year.
It's incredible.
And then in 1975...
You know what the chord was?
It was a G.
Flat or sharp?
It was a G. Sorry. And the song Next Year from Portugal from 1975 was Hey, We Started a Revolution.
Wow. Okay, that's exciting.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking about with the collapse, my main beef, of course, with the collapse of the Soviet Union is that the Eurovision had to expand to incorporate.
All we did was we took over Intervision.
Right, but it meant that, because the Eurovision when I was a kid, it took maybe a couple of hours. But
it
now,
took about 2 hours 10.
Thanks to Latvia, Estonia, WrestleMania, all of those, you now have heats and eliminations. And it just, it's grown to allow, you know,
to have a go.
If indeed they bother.
Well, it depends. Do you mean Macedonia, the region of Greece that the Greeks call Macedonia, or do you mean Macedonia that the Greeks call the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, that they actually call Macedonia because they live there and they don't give a flying two hoots what the Greeks think?
The second one.
Yeah, they've been there since about 95.
I feel like I'm plugging my show from 2 years ago when I talked about history in great detail.
That's right. Well, let's plug the show now.
Oh, goodness.
Because that's slick. Your new favourite David Tennant lookalike comedian, who is 2 or 3 years late because it's now Peter Capaldi doing Doctor Who. So the David Tennant joke is lost because, let's face it, people who come to the Fringe don't do Broadchurch.
Well, possibly not.
Star, your new favourite comedian.
I didn't try and make myself look partially like David Tennant. That's just a coincidence.
Yes. You're also wearing a red tie on the flyer as well, yeah, not a white silk one.
I know, well, I didn't have the white silk one then, did
I? You've got Tipex. You know, when you get all the little minions to staple reviews.
Ladies and gentlemen, I will be manually correcting my flyers to rectify
yes,
this.
Because you're going
to
make people staple their review lines, which is, he looks a bit like Matt Smith.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you know a lot about Doctor Who as well.
Yeah. Look at this. I don't get out much. Beard, Fringe, Doctor Who, Eurovision. Yeah, Doctor having to review Gordon Southern Show without actually seeing the show. Yeah. Go on, get out of here.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Pleasance, for the croissant.
Indeed. 5:30 p.m. there every day right through until the end of Fringe. Gordon Southern, your new favourite comedian. And let's be honest, 6 years ago, he was. Some guests lie very attentively, sitting on the chair, leaning forward. Some of them are very studious, and Lucy Ball is just throwing herself back on the leather armchair, throwing the legs up, boots on the seats, and, you know, like she owns the place, like some sort of demented drag artist, just going, darling, interview me.
Yes, that's me, because that's who I really am on the inside, a demented drag artist. This couch looks so comfortable and so inviting and so warm and cuddly and friendly, and you look so warm and cuddly and friendly, and so I just felt right at home.
Cool. It also probably reminds you of your therapist's chair back in New York.
Yes, of course. My
you actually do have a therapist?
I don't.
You don't? Right, okay.
I'm sorry.
I don't believe therapists exist. I just think people make them up for television.
Yeah, exactly.
We need to be exposition here. Let's get that therapist thing in, you know, and they can talk about their problems without us having to write a script or anything.
Yeah,
they don't exist. I've never met anybody in real life who can go, oh, I have a therapist.
No, I mean, in the States, everybody has a therapist. So to be a little bit different, be a little bit of a renegade, if you don't have a therapist, you're like, wow, you don't have a therapist?
You have America, and then you have New York, which is a bit different to the rest of America anyway.
Yes, but there are a lot of Americans in New York. See, that's the problem. No, I'm joking. But it's like not
they're not
having,
real Americans.
it's like not having a credit card in America. I haven't had it. I only got a credit card like 6 months ago. And before that, I was like an outcast, like an evil, weird creature roaming the lands without a credit card. People would be like, you don't have a credit card?
Things when I go to America, and because we have credit cards in the UK, we've got the little chip in them, so you have to put in a PIN number and you have to sign.
Those are more like debit cards.
No, you have debit cards and you have credit cards. Oh. Credit cards have the chip and PIN as well, and you have to sign for them. In America, you can pay for $200, you just go, there's the card, they just go, yeah, all right, man.
Yeah.
I mean, where's the security in that?
No security. No. They want your identity to get stolen. We have identity theft. Do you guys have that here? No.
Yeah, you had a big case in 2000, didn't you? Somebody decided that they were going to be the president instead of the real president.
Probably. I have a lot of friends whose identities have been stolen, and it's no joke.
Cool. Like, so, joining me now, we have Lucy Porter.
Paul, yes, Lucy.
Identity stolen. Was yes, it? No, exactly. It's going to lead into the joke
I'm
there.
Sorry, fuck, I didn't get
that. No, yeah, didn't go that. No, not on the ball fast enough, too early in the day.
I'm sorry, too early in the day. And also, I'm still just trying to get on board with the Scottish humor.
You meant accent there, not humor. If I just go to here, you're just going to make a million dollars. If I just go ahead, just tell us about your show.
Oh, yes. My show, Lucy Pole, Hi Hitler. Hi Hitler. Is an autobiographical solo blitz comedy, 60 minutes, about my life growing up in a crazy, wild family of artists, feeling like an alien wherever I went, being fascinated by Hitler at age 4.
Hitler?
Adolf Hitler.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there's been a lot of them. Yeah. There were some Renaissance artists in the 16th century that were called Hitler.
Oh, yes, of course. Not to forget those.
Yeah, so it's one surname. It's just like saying Bush.
No, it's the one with the little mustache and the side part.
That okay, is. Right.
The one that liked Brown a lot. Eva Brown. So, yeah, I was fascinated by Hitler. I also loved David Hasselhoff. And I moved.
So is there a connection there?
Yeah, there's a connection because Germans love David
Hasselhoff. Oh, you're going about the holding out for freedom as he went over the wall.
Yeah,
right, okay.
Looking for freedom. He brought the wall down. Everybody knows that, right? Moving around Germany, New York, Germany, being an alien, and the tragically funny events that occurred in my life.
So excellent. Far. Okay, we've got more than enough material there for the rest of the interview. Yay! Let's start with the first. What's that? What's blitz comedy? I know what comedy is, but what's blitz comedy? Is that where you put the lights out and everybody puts tin hats on?
No. It's a short, sweet, fast comedy. It's like a Blitzkrieg, just a comedy. Yeah.
But you're doing a whole... So you're doing an hour of fast Blitzkrieg comedy. So it's just basically it's hyperactive then?
It's pretty hyperactive. It's very high energy, yeah. It's a very high energy show.
Okay, right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's what where the blitz comes in. Blitz means lightning in German. So that's what that is.
Okay, right then. Good. Great, I learned something. Why Hitler?
Okay, so I'm Jewish. I'm German. Growing up, you know, there was a lot of talk of Hitler around. And so I was fascinated by him, this creature, this man. You know, he's very comical, and to a little child that doesn't really know what evil is, this man with a little mustache and a side part who talks like this and throws his hands up. And I thought that he was holding up a peace sign, and I thought that people said, Hi Hitler, like a greeting. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know about Heil. I didn't know what the fuck that meant, and it's silly anyway. And so that was the thing. And I was fascinated by him. And I didn't know that he was evil, and which amused my parents. So they didn't really tell me to stop being fascinated by him.
So is it... Because really there's two Hitlers there that you've kind of talked about. There is the sort of, for want of a better word, the stage persona. Mm-hmm. The Charlie Chaplin moustache, yep. the walks, the, oh, we have pinned the British down at Dunkirk. You know what? Let them have some tea. No, it's lucky. They'll be there tomorrow. They're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
But there's also the actual, not the character, the man. The man who did pull Germany out of economic and political recession in the 20s, who created a huge manufacturing base, and did, for a very brief moment, look like he was going to be the ruler of the world until everybody went, hold on a minute.
Yeah.
But, you know, the contrast between the comic and the person is a very fertile space.
Mm. Yes, I mean, I was like 4 and 5 and 6 when I had this fascination.
And I'm guessing this would be mostly for the comic side of it.
Yes. Or, you know, as a child, through the eyes of a child, naive, kind of just... also because there was so much talk of him and the war, and it was all around all the time, because for Germans it's a big issue, obviously, especially for post-war kids, you know? And so I think at that point I obviously didn't understand or know the other person, you know, the political side, and none of that. For me, it was just this character with this funny mustache and this funny hair, and he was dressed up in a uniform, and people were talking about him. And so I think it was my way of, I guess, like digesting or dealing with this character and this like person being around and being talked about. And I, you know, children are very sensitive, so they pick up on problems and issues, right? And then they kind of filter it through their eyes and put out their version of what it's doing to their brain, you know? So I think that's what it was. And I think I was always very bossy when I was a kid. I'm still very bossy. Stop looking at me. No, I'm joking. And so I guess maybe that was an attraction too, you know, like this dictator kind of thing. I also later had a fascination with Napoleon for no apparent reason. So yeah, those things melted together and formed my comical, naive, innocent liking for him. Yeah. And then, like I said, I thought people were saying, "Hi, Hitler." You know, I'll never forget. It's the same, for example, 101 Dalmatians. There's Cruella de Vil, right? Cruel devil. When I didn't speak English, for me, it was just Cruella de Vil, like a name. And I'd sing Cruella de Vil. And when we moved to the States and I learned English, I had this moment where, like it was like enlightenment. I was like, oh my God, cruel devil, Cruella de Vil. And so it's like the same. Hi, Hitler. Oh, hi, Hitler. Hi, how are you? Mm-hmm. And then there was like this moment of, oh, Heil Hitler. Oh, shit. Okay. So.
And there we go there. And you can take all of that and turn it into a friendship show. Yay.
Exactly. Thank you, Hitler. Yay.
Yay.
Yoo-hoo. But it also has a little bit of a deeper resonance for me because my show is very much about being a fish out of water, right? It's a fish out of water story. And so the Second World War, being Jewish and being German, my whole family has been displaced and ripped out of one place and put into another. And this sense of not belonging and not having a home is therefore like in my DNA because of the Second World War. So that has like my personal resonance in the title, and Hitler is kind of also that, you know, he's the reason that that this sense of not belonging has been passed down to me.
And let's face it, The Fringe is slightly cheaper than a mythical 3 weeks of a therapist in New York.
So much cheaper.
So much cheaper.
And so much more attractive. And you can smoke. You could never smoke in a therapist's office. And here I can just, you know, smoke away.
Not on stage, you can't. You're not allowed to smoke indoors in Scotland.
In my head.
Oh, in your head, right? That's right. Okay, hey. No laws being broken here. We will not. There we go. Lucy, remind us when the show is on.
The show is on at 4:15 every day, Gilded Balloon Sportsman's. 4:15.
Okay, and if people want to find out more online about you,
it's www.highhitlershow.com, all one word, and you can follow me on Twitter at Lucy Pohl Comedy. That's LuciePohl Comedy. And yeah, you can stalk me, follow me home, send me messages, tell your grandmother about me.
There we go. And we'll have links back to all of those as usual on our website, edinburghfringe.thepodcastcorner.com.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
There is a moment in every Fringe where you go, that's the first person that's given me one of those laughs that could possibly cause me pain. That man is Tom Rhodes. He joins me on the podcast now. So first of all, congratulations, Tom.
Hey, thanks. Hey. It's always good to start a chat with a compliment.
Yeah, good. You get I don't actually have a badge. I should maybe make a badge one up. I have the top of a jam lid. You know, it's shiny.
No, I mean, that really makes me happy because you've seen thousands of comedians and
just for the Fringe, not, you know.
But I mean, you've probably been doing this for years, and that's a huge compliment. Thank you.
And I'll even say what the joke was. It was also the first joke I've heard this year, all told, the whole year, on the Malaysian Airlines. You know, there's a point of God, when is something fair game for a comic? For a comic like yourself, and the various, obviously there's the tragedies with the airliners, but comedy has to reflect life. And you went there.
Well, I mean, I don't do a big 5-minute dissertation on the tragedy. I mean, it's just a line, and I was just in Malaysia, you know, and I didn't fly Malaysian Airlines for obvious reasons. And that I wrote before the second tragedy. And my wife is from Holland. I was just in Amsterdam last week when the bodies came into Holland, and it was a national day of mourning. They had a moment of silence at 4, and it was really impressive to see how the Dutch dealt with their tragedy, because it was total silence. Where in the United States, if we had something like that, there'd be an announcer just babbling on and on incessantly. Oh, and people are by the road. Oh, and look at this, and pointing out shit you can see for yourself. It was really classy the way the Dutch dealt with it. I mean, you know, there, certain tragedies you can't go too soon. Yeah. But, you know, it's some things you can't resist.
And this is what I want to bring up, because I know that when my wife listens back to this one, when I've heard, oh, this is stuff about the Malaysian analogy, she's going to go and sort of thin the lips and go, you're going to go there? But comedy almost has a demand that it has to go to those places, that it has to examine life with the ups and the downs and the huge negatives as well.
Well, and it seems to me, you know, I've been a keen observer of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival for a long time, that like when things happen in that year up to that moment of the festival, everything is fair game for comedians to talk about. I mean, in my own life, I mean, there's certain jokes, like just tragedies transcend, you know, I mean, like my sister died of breast cancer. If someone makes a breast cancer joke, I don't find it funny, but I can see as a comedian that the line is funny, the way it's structured, the punchline, things like that. It depends what has struck you personally, whether it's cancer, a drunk driver, you know, you're Palestinian. You know, it's horrific what's going on in Israel right now. And I've got a line because I'm from Orlando, Florida. And it's where I grew up, and it's a really cheesy place, you know? There's no culture. It's amusement parks.
And air conditioning.
Yeah, loads of air conditioning. And there's an amusement park there called the Holy Land Experience. And what they've done is they've recreated ancient Jerusalem at a highway exit. And I have to say the place is very authentic because the parking lot is full of Palestinians, and they can't get in. And it's like, you know, I wrote that joke years ago. Because I'm from Orlando, and I think the Holy Land Experience is a pretty ignorant, stupid, fanatical theme park. And now to say it, it has so much more implications because of, you know,
current
what
conditions.
The Israelis are doing to Gaza and the people there. So that wasn't my intention. It's just that's the beauty of humor, you know? I mean, you don't know how things are going to strike people. And then, like I said before, people have certain sensitivities. I mean, if you're a bleeding heart liberal like I think I am, I mean, I'm moved by news things. And when I see people make jokes, you know, those little, you know, your little red flags. Oh, wow, I shouldn't laugh at that. But, you know, I'm a comedian first and foremost, and that's my nationality. So I think everything's fair game. You know, I mean, like there was a big controversy in the States about rape jokes last year. Me personally, find it the least funny thing in the world, especially child rape. Nothing, no topic in the world disgusts me more than that. And yet, there's loads of comedians that do it. I mean, you know, I don't condemn them. I don't think it's funny, and I don't do it myself, you know?
So, how long have you been in comedy now? So,
30
years. Bouncing around. Why decide to do Edinburgh now?
What a good question.
I love it when people go, what a good question, because what it actually says to me is 5 seconds stalling time.
To gather your thought, absolutely.
And I'm just giving you a little bit more. Generous
and,
host.
And I have a podcast, and as an interviewer, I'm always stroked when someone says good question, you know, because you have put effort into your questions.
Yeah.
You know? And then I just had 15 more seconds to
indeed,
think of
yeah.
my answer.
But I'm building up tension. The listeners at home going, is he actually going to answer?
Well,
is he going to answer? Is he just going to...
Had you not asked that question, you would not have this pertinent piece of information. In the United States, I am known as an international comedian because I do all these international circuits, Asia.
Not just because you've got a passport.
Yeah, well, because I've been to Canada. They think I'm international. But the reason I got in with all these international circuits in Asia, Australia, and, you know, all these gigs all over Europe. I got all of them because I got in with London and the UK. Many years ago, I took systematic trips over to London and got in, and that led to all the work that I've done around the world. So the Edinburgh Festival has always been very important to me. And I don't think a lot of American comedians know about it or even give a shit about it. To me personally, it's important because, you know, I've gained so much from your area. And, you know, the Edinburgh Festival, it's the biggest, you know, arts comedy festival in the world. So I came to investigate in 1999 and 2000 because you shouldn't just jump into something. And there was a show at Leighton Live at the old Calgate location, which was notorious for heckling. And it was an all-American lineup. This is August 2000, remember. It was hosted by Louis Schaefer. And a lot of people had gone there specifically to heckle Louis Schaefer. And it was vicious, and it was mean. And I admit, I found it amusing. But it turned into the most anti-American hate rally you've ever seen in your life. And one American comedian after another. It was lambs to the slaughter. And my good friend Rich Hall was supposed to close the show. Somewhere during the show, he mysteriously gets laryngitis. And he asked me if I would be willing to take his spot. Me, being the arrogant son of a bitch that I am, I think they're going to love me. So I'm backstage. I'm pounding all this beer to get extra liquid courage. And the sound man fucked me. I'm not a flag waver by any means, and I'm proudly the communist of my family. The sound man played God Bless America as I walked out, and this already rabid anti-American audience, they went apeshit, and I couldn't even get started. They're deafening. They're yelling, and fuck you, and go back to America, and I tried to start, couldn't start, and I had this very serene moment where I sat down and I lit a cigarette and I sat Indian style on the stage and I just soaked it in. I can still see this cinematic panoramic scope of all these ugly contorted faces and the spittle coming out of their mouth and fuck you and go back to America. And for the last 15 years, that's been my Vietnam. I'll wake up in cold sweats in the middle of the night, and I think I'm still on that stage.
Did you finish the cigarette?
Well, yeah. And
that was it. No, I'm not leaving until I finish.
Yeah. I don't even remember that detail. But so, you know, when that place burned down in 2006, I saw it on the news, and I have to say the comedian in me smirked. But I've always wanted to do the Edinburgh Festival. I think any comedian worth his salt, no matter where you are in the world, should do it at least once. And I've been a comedian 30 years. You know, people die. I've had some, my sister and my father died recently. And, you know, before I dropped dead, I wanted to do the Edinburgh Festival. And so it means a lot to me. And I thought, you know, tough it up. If you get bad reviews or whatever, it's just something in life you're going to have to deal with. You know, like my brother always says, suck it up, pussy.
I'm just trying to get nervous. That's probably quite bad over here. It's not bad in America as well.
No, my brother's a bully, and he's a right-wing Christian military guy. But that's been his lifelong advice to me. It means to be tough and to deal with something. So, yeah, I'm really, really, I'm thrilled to be here.
So, how do you prep for Edinburgh when you are a comic who's coming? Although with London career, from the outside, do you do anything different compared to things like Montreal or Adelaide or any of the other comedy festivals?
Montreal, you know, you do short sets. I mean, unless you were a really big name headliner, like Jimmy Carr or somebody like that doing a massive room, you would only do 20-minute sets at the Montreal Festival. And most of the time you're doing 7-minute sets. And then it's a lot of comedians doing 7s and 20-minute sets. So here, you know, you're doing an hour. I did the Soho Theater in London in February. I'm doing it again after this. And it's such a luxury to go on stage where opening acts have not fouled up the bathwater. And you've got an entire hour slab of time to paint whatever thing you want. For me, I've got a lot of stories of things that have happened to me. And and I've got a lot of excellent one-liners and stuff. For Edinburgh, is finding the right balance between stories I want to tell that are important to me or I think are funny, and getting out my favorite jokes that I've written in, you know, however long. So, you know, I want to bust people's heads open with the best shit I've got.
Are you going to do Late and Live?
Three times, in fact.
Yeah. It's calmed down very slightly.
Yeah, I've heard. Yeah, and I saw the way. And the, I was thrilled that that press release is in the, where the Late and Room, Late and Live is now. And I was like, oh, this isn't so tough. Where the other one was like, I went in there at night. I mean, there was just, it was just all extras from Train Spotting, you know?
It's still one of our traditions here at the Fringe. Late and Live, you still got to be able to suck it up, as they say.
No, I can handle it. I've done, you know, I've done, I mean, I've been a comedian a long time. I thrive in chaos. So, you know.
We have a lot of that. Right. A lot of that. Remind us once more when the show is on.
I am at the Wine Bar at the Gilded Balloon at 9:15.
And do you have dates for the Late and Live appearances yet?
I'm doing a I do not, off the top of my head, no.
We'll have them online, Facebooks, Twitters, anything like that? Hooked up.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. You can find everything at tomrhodes.net. And I have a podcast that is very dear to my heart called Tom Rhodes Radio, which is on iTunes and everywhere podcasts.
You're doing some of them over here in
Scotland? I am indeed, yeah.
Lovely. All right, we will have links to all of them back on our website. As always, edinburghfringe.thepodcastcorner.com. Head there to subscribe to this show and links to subscribe to Tom's as well. Tom, enjoy your Edinburgh experience this year.
Respect, brother.
All summery now. That's lovely. And given that I'm in Scotland and the temperature is above 5 degrees, it's summer. I don't care if it's raining or not. It's a pre-record. It might be raining when we're in. Oh, I don't know. Anyway, we have the cast, some of the cast and the people, the tech people and the music and everything from the show Manuelita. Camilo is on the
cuatro,
the mini bass guitar. Yes. Mini acoustic bass guitar.
Here we go. Vengo a trobar este golpe que un amigo me mandó pa' que mañana o pasado haga lo mismo con yo.
And as we would say around these parts, no point. Which means more to Europeans than anybody else. And we have Tamsin as well, from Manuelita as well. Tell us a little bit about the show.
The show is based on Manuela Sáenz, who was the lover of Simón Bolívar, who was the liberator of South America from the Spanish. But she was a revolutionary in her own right, and so the show is basically her claiming her revolution for herself, basically, and not retelling, but telling the story as she would like it to be told.
So this is a new production for the Fringe.
Yes, brand new. It's very exciting.
So who's been involved in the writing and what are you up to in the show?
So me writing, and we have Scarlett, who has directed it, and Camilo, who's joined us with the musical side of things, musical writing. Because it is, I think, it's a real musical, there's a real musical element to the show and it drives the narrative forward.
It's just a shame we didn't have any narrative here to drive us forward on the podcast.
Oh, absolutely. What would
that was your cue, Camilo! So, why decide to write this story?
I read an article in the newspaper that called, sort of said the harlot of the Americas was going to be, her symbolic remains were being transported to lie next to Simón Bolívar's in the Pantheon in Venezuela. And I knew Simón Bolívar, and I was like, harlot of the Americas? The whole of the Americas? Wow, that's a pretty good title. So I looked her up, and I couldn't find anything on her. And so I decided to look some more. I went to South America to look for her, and there was much more information over there, and she was slightly more recognised, and had just recently, her symbolic remains had been taken from her supposed death place to Venezuela. And she was this great woman who lived and loved and fought, and yet she was just completely forgotten about. And, I mean, it was nice that they were now recognising her. I kind of thought, what would she think to that? Like, her symbolic remains being kind of removed. I mean, it's kind
of... The symbolic remains just sound...
Yeah, it's just like some dust.
Yeah, it's like the sort of thing that the UN would treat as a weapons-grade grave. You know, just like, that can go over there. It's okay.
Flags and things covering it. And it was just... I kind of thought to myself, I wonder what she would have thought of that. And actually, knowing as much as I know about her now, I think she would... She would love the brilliant extravagance of it all. And
so tell us about her place in history then. Where does she fit into the fabric of that period of the Venezuelan history?
So in sort of the beginning of the 19th century, Simón Bolívar was leading his troops, the Patriotas, in a revolution against the Spanish crown. And that was involving Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador. It wasn't Ecuador at the time, but it was kind of Alto Peru. And then, and what is now Bolivia as well. And so that whole area was fighting for their independence. And Simón Bolívar was at the front of that. And Manuela fits in. Most people think she fits in as just his lover, but actually she was working for the independent cause a lot earlier than that. She was, as most women were in the fight were doing, she was a spy, and so she was passing underground information. She was married to an Englishman, actually, and she was going to the parties in all the Spanish salons. So she was a perfect person as a kind of interconnection.
Move between all the circles.
Moving between, and she was very good at playing the role of the good Senora Thorne, and then she would take all the information down, and her big thing was the big batallón that was in Lima at the time where she lived. Her brother was fighting for the Spanish in it, and she got in and she convinced him and 700 soldiers. You can kind of make up the story as you like, and she did it all in a night, and you know, and she was like yes, and she converted them and she got them fighting for Bolívar's side, and then they eventually won. But then after that, the story...
And then they eventually won.
And then they eventually won, and everything was fine. But then, of course, as all great stories, there was lots of twists and turns. And once they were all independent, they wanted different things, and the camp splits, and it all goes a bit haywire. And she didn't really... Women no longer had a role in the revolution. In the revolution, everyone gets involved, and it's underground spies, and it's women, and it's men, and it doesn't really matter. But then once everything becomes a little bit more settled, the women are back to their place in society, and they're like, no, now we've got government, you can't be involved. And I think she found that really difficult. So, and she got a bad reputation for being the feisty revolutionary that she really was. And so, yeah, she got...
How important is it then to you as a writer to be able to take this story and know that it's not fiction?
I mean, I really like the story because... there was so little information on her that I could find, and the information that I could find was kind of people saying stories about her. You know, Latin America is full of, as we say, sort of, you know, gossip and hearsay and all of that. And so what I really liked was that there were some great stories about her that were clearly not true. There's this story that she ran away with an officer when she was at the convent. And when I went to see the convent, I mean, the stories that she climbed over the wall. I mean, the wall is like 100 foot high, you know, and she climbs over it and runs away with him. And so I like, for this story that we use, the show that we've got, is that she mixes both of them. And so she's able to look at both of them and pick and choose and sort of say, well, you know, maybe I want the little, you know, Romeo and Juliet story with the balcony, but, you know, this is also how it happened. And I think that that's an important part of storytelling. It's got to be part fact and part fiction. I say it's part fact, part fiction, and full of fancy.
Yes, there we go. We have the entertainment in there. We have a little bit of the education as well. And we have Camilo with me, bass guitar, quarter thing. Because there's music going along in the show as well, isn't
there? Yeah, and it's a huge part of the storytelling and the relationship between Manuelita and the musician. I mean, it's kind of... It's very sweet, and he kind of... brings her down to earth when she's there sort of going like, yes, I was this amazing person. He's kind of like, yeah, you weren't that amazing, you know. So he brings it down, and there's always bringing her back down to earth, so it's not too...
He's so getting written out of the story when the revolution's over. First up against the woman, the revolution is not here. Go. It was all me.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, what do you mean I'm being written out as well? Hold on, there we go. So we've got time probably to squeeze in just a little bit from the piece, yes?
Yeah. The music from the piece. Yeah. Should we do Duerme mi tripón?
Okay.
Okay.
Let's get you to sit there.
As in a song, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. ¿Lo puedes con esto? Duerme mi tripón. Vamos a engañar la lechuza y engañar al coco. ya no asusta. Duerme mi tripón. Duerme mi tripón. Ya se fue la tarde cansada y llegó la noche fresquita y muda. Duerme mi tripón.
It sounds lovely. It's probably a limerick about jumping over a wall and pretending to be a frog. But if you want to find that in context... Oh, shit, don't spoil the magic.
Anis!
¿Qué está de conmigo?
Cerveza, cerveza.
Soleto. That's Belarusian. There we go. Anyway, right, remind us when the show is on again. Then,
yes, 12:40 p.m. every day at the Underbelly Cowgate.
Cool. You have Camilo there every day as well?
Every day.
Oh, yes, I'm going to be there smiling and playing my beautiful guitar. Woo-hoo. And the quattro.
Yeah, the guitar and the quattro. He's got both. Oh, multi-talented.
Multi-talented. And he's got a little egg that shakes.
A little egg that shakes. What? Which is what we call a biological clock. There you go. Time's in, Camilo. Thanks for coming along.
Thank you very
Best
much.
Of luck with the show. Have fun at the Fringe.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you too. Thank you.
And there we go. That is your podcast for today. Thank you all very much for listening. As always, links are back at the website, edinburghfringe.thepodcastcorner.com. We will have our children's interview show tomorrow. And we'll be back in the studio on Monday, streaming live at showradio.org, K107, Radio 6. And, of course, the podcast is always available on the website and through iTunes. And if you feel like mood for giving us a review, iTunes is always available there. 1 to 5 stars and a little bit of comments. Always appreciated. Last time we were in the top 10 performing arts podcast. I'd like to stay there and maybe get top 3 and get close to the Archers before the end of the run. Thanks for listening. We'll be around tomorrow and we'll catch you live again on Sunday.